Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk again to Joram van Cleveren. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum and Ramadan Mubarak.
Yeah, alaikum salam and Ramadan Kareem.
Nice. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming back on again. You've been on several times, hugely popular speaker. So really grateful you've found time from your busy schedule to come on. And as many people know, you're a former member of the Dutch Parliament, a representative of the Party for Freedom, as it was called, or is called. And you had submitted numerous bills related to Islam, such as those calling for the cut, your extraordinary personal and theological journey in this highly recommended book. There we are. Apostate, a fantastic cover. That's the back of it as well. I've read it, and I really do recommend that. It's your most extraordinary journey. And today, Joram has kindly agreed to give us his assessment of the current political situation for Muslims in Europe and what many see as the hypocrisy of European politics and the war on Gaza and the more general situation of Muslims in Europe as well. So what are your thoughts about this?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. It's a great honor, and I love Blogging Theology. I always watch the several programs, and I think I love it. It's a good content always. So thank you from my side that having me on the show. Yeah, well, I think just like in the UK, when we look at continental Europe, there is a big problem when it comes to pressure on the Islamic communities. Of course, it is related to several geopolitical problems. Think about, for example, Gaza. There's a big problem. And of course, when you look at all the elections and the outcomes of elections in several European countries like the Netherlands, the country I'm from, but also in Portugal, when you look at Sweden, Italy, you see all these far-right anti-Islam organization starting to win and starting to become really part of the government as well. So it's not only that they're an opposition party anymore, but they are really a government right now. And in the Netherlands now, we have the Freedom Party, my old party. They won big time. It's the biggest win ever. They have almost like 25% of the Dutch seats in parliament now. And they are trying to establish a new government here. And I think they will manage to do it. So we'll see. But it's not a good development, of course, not for the Muslims and for everybody who loves freedom.
No, it's very, very, very worrying indeed. And you were saying to me briefly before we started recording that you're off to the Dutch Parliament shortly. Explain to us what's going on in the Dutch Parliament at the moment. Why that's such an issue?
Yeah, of course. Well, there are several topics right now that are hot, so to say. One of them is, of course, is the whole the negotiations to form a new coalition here. That's the Freedom Party, and they will work together with the Liberal Party. That's the old party of our current Prime Minister, Mark Rutte. And there's Farmers' Party. I don't know if you heard of it. There are a lot of farmer protests in France, in Belgium, in the Netherlands, and they have like an own political party in the Netherlands as well. And that party also won, and they are very willing to work together with the Freedom Party. And there is this smaller new organization that's more anti-governmental, but still, so to say, mainstream. And those four parties are trying to establish a new government. So we'll see about that, because I think it's very worrisome. But there's also another topic here, is that the Dutch government is responsible for the service of the F-35 fighter jets of the Israeli army. And there has been a court decision 3-4 weeks ago that the government should stop with this service. But they continue anyway.
Why did the court, the Dutch court, rule that it was they had to stop supplying these weapons to Israel, the Israeli government? What was the reason?
Yeah, the reason is that they said, well, we see that there is a war going on, and that the people of Gaza, the Palestinian people, are almost exterminated by what we see. Because we have hunger now as a weapon, as the UN spoke, and they talked about genocide. So they said, well, there is a possible genocide going on. Maybe. So in the Dutch constitution, they say it's illegal to participate in things like that. So they said you have to stop supplying those weapons. But the Dutch government did it anyway, and they still do it. So it's a big issue right now here in the Netherlands, because,
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
They don't follow the law. Then we have a really big problem, of course.
It's extraordinary. So you have a court in Holland saying stop supplying weapons. Where Palestinians are being genocided, and your own government is ignoring. Morally they should stop, let alone for legal reasons, but they're continuing in defiance of the law, of a court ruling. That's most remarkable, because I thought Dutch was a law-abiding country that respected, you know, freedom and the rule of law and not killing people indiscriminately. And it's shocking then it seems that the Dutch government is ignoring that. That's quite something. And this is not even this is not Geert Wilders' party, is it?
Saying yeah, apparently when it comes to it.
So is it?
No. It's like I said, it's the Liberal Party of the current
Liberal Party.
Prime Minister Mark Rutte, and he also said that he supports Israel unconditionally.
Wow,
a Liberal Party, yeah. So, well, liberal in the continental context is a little bit different, I think, than when you compare it to the US or the UK, because liberal here doesn't mean per se that you are truly liberal. You can also be, strangely enough, very conservative and still be liberal, because it really has to do with economics. So it's an economic liberal party, so low taxes, stuff like that. But on the other hand, they are very conservative. But this party isn't conservative. So it's just like it has no ideology anymore. The only ideology they have, and that's what people who are member of this party, even members of parliament, said, it's only about power. And when it comes to Israel, apparently there are other rules than law. And I think that's very worrisome, not only for the people of Palestine and the people of the Netherlands, because we have to, we have the rule of law, at least you think. It's a very, very strange, twisted context we're in. And the hypocrisy of what you see in a lot of Western governments when it comes to Israel and Palestine is very, very disturbing, I think.
Well, it is. And you say it's very strange. And I mean, historically, Holland or Netherlands have stood for tolerance and freedom and respect for individual rights and so on. And now not only are they defiant of the court ruling, which says you mustn't arm a country that's probably committing genocide. Say probably, I think that was what you said. And using hunger or food as a weapon of war, starving the whole population. The UN has said that. I don't quite how we reconcile this. Why is the Dutch government giving unconditional support to this Middle East regime that's doing these things? Why would it do that? If I can ask a very basic and probably naive question, just so I can get my head around it. Is there any answer you can explain?
Yeah, well, in the Netherlands, of course, I think there are three big movements, almost, so to say, or three big actors when it comes to the policies of a lot of Western governments when it comes to Israel. One has to do with theology. That a lot of people here think that Israel is the chosen people. And with Israel, they mean the Jewish people. In general, and that has to do with not only Catholic, but especially modern Protestant theology. And a lot of when I look at the church I'm from, because I was raised as a Orthodox Protestant Christian, they always said, and they pointed to a part of the Bible called Genesis, the first book. And in Genesis, there is this first chapter, I think chapter 12, verse 3. But I can't mistake, maybe it's 6 or 9, I think 3. And it says, whoever blesses Abraham will be blessed by the Lord. And whoever curses Abraham will be cursed by the Lord. And the translation in the church is that Abraham is like a synonym for the people of Israel. So you have to support Israel, the people of Israel, because they are chosen. And whoever blesses Israel will be blessed by the Lord. And whoever curses Israel will be cursed by the Lord.
I don't understand what you've just said, because Genesis, okay, Israel didn't exist. I mean, Abraham was a long, long time before Jacob was born. Jacob is the also known as Israel. He was the first guy, if you like, to be called Israel. He had 12 children who became the famous founders of the 12 tribes of Israel, of Jacob. So Jacob is actually a man. But this was long, long, long after Abraham. So to say that Abraham and Israel / Jordan are somehow the same is historically impossible and anachronistic and bizarre, because it seems just random. I mean, you could say anyone was Israel. I mean, why not Adam? being serious here. I actually don't understand the logic of that. I mean, I was rereading Genesis or the Torah recently, and it's very clear that Abraham wasn't a Jew, wasn't an Israeli. Why? Because these are concepts that were born, if you like, much later with Jacob, who God then called Israel. So is this just ignorance of the Bible? Is it deliberate twisting or distortion of the biblical narrative? Or how are we talking about this interpretation?
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree with what you just said. Yeah. But a lot of people in the Christian church I'm from, and also from a lot of other churches, don't agree with us. Because they say, like you said, Jacob is Israel. And they say, so the house of Israel, and one of the children was, of course, Judah. They say that line goes to Jesus Christ. And they say, well, this is the chosen people. And these chosen people have to be protected, have to be followed. And they don't really see like the historical context. For them, it's like there's in, I think, 1820 till 1830, there was this Irish minister.
Is it Darby?
Yeah, John Nelson Darby. And John Nelson Darby, he fell off his horse. And you know the story, I think. Yeah. He fell off his horse. And then he was at home sick for a year. And of course, when you are a minister, what do you do when you're sitting at home? You start reading your Bible. So he was reading the Bible, and he said, we have to reinterpret this first, because the last couple of centuries, we've seen it all wrong. Jacob is Israel. Israel is the chosen people. So we have to protect and help the Jewish people. So what did this guy do? He went to the United States, and he was a very influential person because he was like a top guy from the English church. And he went back to the UK as well. And he surrounded himself with people who were very influential, very rich, but also very driven. And one of the persons he influenced a lot was Mr. Moody. When you go to the United States now and you want to have like a real evangelical upbringing, you have to Moody Bible School.
In Chicago, Illinois, and I've actually been there. I mean, not studied there, but I've actually been to the church there, and when I was a Christian, of course. Yeah.
Well, of course. Well, then you know. And John Nelson Darby was like his teacher. And another person he thought was Mr. Heckler. And Mr. Heckler was one of his students, so to say. And he said to Mr. Heckler, you have to go to Vienna. Because in Vienna, there is this guy. And this guy is called Mr. Herzl, Theodor Herzl. He's a Jewish man. And he's written an article, the Judenstaat, the Jewish state. And it was written in 1894, so long ago, and long before Israel even existed. And he said, well, this man has a vision. He wants to have a Jewish state. And I, and I'm talking about John Nelson Darby, said, we have the same vision, because we think that the Messiah will return at the moment that all the Jewish people will be gathered in their homeland in Israel. So we have to support them in this project. And that's what he did. So he went, he sent Mr. Heckler to Vienna. He knocked at the door of the house of Mr. Herzl. So knock, knock. And he said, well, I'm here to help. I'm your friend. So Theodor Herzl asked him, yeah, well, who are you? And he explained, we have the same vision, etc. And it is this man, Mr. Heckler, with the help of John Nelson Darby, that opened a lot of political doors for Mr. Herzl, because back then, of course, the whole context was very anti-Semitic. A lot of people in the English government, the Dutch government, German, France, doesn't matter. Everybody disliked the Jewish community and Jews in general, because it was very anti-Semitic context. But he opened the door politically, and then, of course, this political context started to change. And in the end, of course, adding everything up, including all the horrible things that happened during World War II, that made, like, there is Israel now. So to go back to the question, what is it? I think this is one very important thing that a lot of people don't think about, but the whole context when it comes to supporting Israel has to do with especially Protestant theology. And because of the evangelicals in the United States are still very, very strong, and they're all related to this kind of thinking. And you still have like little spots, so to say, in continental Europe of very influential, very powerful people, they think the same. So this is the theology part, so to say. And then, of course, you have like the part of the anti-Muslim organizations that are really rising. And when I look at my old party, it's very secular. The Freedom Party was very secular. It was one of the critiques of my grandfather. He said, why would you work for an atheist? That's another story. But they're very secular. And they said, well, we don't care about theology. We don't believe anything when it comes to God or the spiritual or metaphysics or whatever. We only support Israel because they are fighting our fight. We are in a war with Islam, an historical war, and they are fighting our fight in the Middle East. So they are our Western base in the Middle East. It was literally what the Freedom Party said. And they also said Palestine already exists. It's called Jordan. So the state is Palestine. So they said the whole country of Israel, even with the Golan parts of Lebanon, even a little part of Turkey, and in the south, the Sinai and Egypt, it's all Israel. And we should fight for them because this country of Israel becomes bigger, it's more Western, more our culture in the Middle East. So we can fight them, the enemy, and in their view, it's Islam and the Muslims, better. So that's the only reason they help and they support Israel. So it's nothing to do with theology. That's very anti-Islam. They say we're in a war with Islam. We have to protect the West, and they are fighting our fight. So give them money, give them weapons. And then, of course, there's the third thing, the third part, and that has to do with like the current policies of so to say, mainstream Western governments, our government, like we talked about the F-35, the jet, but also when it comes to oil, when it comes to gas, geopolitical strategic position of Israel, of course, when you look at the United States, they want to be close to Iran, you have the Suez Canal, of course. So, and that's why they support Israel. A famous speech of Mr. Biden, the current president, in 1986, he said, if there was no Israel, we should have invented an Israel. Why? And he said it explicitly, said, because they serve our interests in the Middle East and beyond. So I think the combination of these three makes it very, very hard for people to penetrate or change the support that a lot of Western governments have right now for the state of Israel.
And yet, thank you for sharing that. It's a very lucid and a very interesting perspective. And yet we are seeing, if I'm not mistaken, an increasing number, maybe a majority of young people in the States, in Europe, who are watching TikTok and other social media. They're seeing the reality on the ground of what's happening. Unbelievable pictures we're seeing on Twitter every day of appalling carnage and great crimes against humanity taking place. And they're not fooled by this narrative that it's just, the West defending itself against Islam. They see the carnage.
Hence the American government says, let's ban TikTok.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, so,
not the only thing, of course, but I think it is crucial, because what you say, social media is almost a threat to the mainstream narrative in the West, because Islam is dangerous, Muslims are scary, we are right, they are wrong. And as for the older generation, it was easy, and they have like the history of the Second World War, and that's all true.
Yeah.
But things change, and of course, the whole geopolitical situation is different than, let's say, 80 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very worrying. I mean, if you get a sense at all of a religious revival, I don't mean amongst Muslims, I mean among Christians in the West, in response to these different factors, because there's definitely a revival of Islam globally, but is there a similar kind of revival of Christianity, or is that still on its inexorable decline in the West, do you think?
Well, it is declining still. And in the Netherlands, we have a research that's done every 10 years. It's called God in the Netherlands. And they started in 1966. And every 10 years, they give like an update and an upgrade because they expand research and they ask, what do you believe? Do you believe in a heaven? Do you really believe in hell? Do you believe in the Bible, etc.? Do you believe in a personal God, etc.? And For the first time in 2016, so in about 2 years, we have a new one. But in 2016, that's the most current research that is done on this topic. The researchers said Christianity is marginalized. The Netherlands is not a Christian country anymore, because over 80% said we have no connection with the Christian culture, we have no connection with the Christian religion, we have no connection with it at all. So, and they said, well, that was remarkable, said that, because they didn't thought it was declining that fast.
Really?
So in the Netherlands, especially, and all, it's the same goes for Belgium, for example, also all Scandinavian countries, so Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, it's all going down when it comes to Christianity. So it's really is changing. And I think that is another thing that's very worrisome, because we're now talking about Gaza, of course, that the connection that people have and the understanding of and for religion in general is almost gone in a lot of Western countries. So if someone says, I'm talking about my freedom of religion, or I think it's very dear to me to be able to pray, a lot of people think that, well, these people are crazy. What are they talking about? Praying, God, religion. So it's very hard almost in general to be religious in the West.
Extraordinary. I mean, what role is there, do you think, of dawah in terms of Muslims sharing information and knowledge about Islam and calling to Islam in Holland? What dawah projects exist in Holland? And is this in any way, do you think, a way of pushing back against this encroaching Islamophobia and hostility and demonization and marginalization of Muslims in Europe, which is happening everywhere, is beginning to happen, unfortunately, here in the UK with we're seeing more extreme statements from the government demonizing and marginalizing Muslims who have any views in the public domain. We've been told to shut up, basically. But what role does dawah play, do you think, in actually changing this situation?
Yeah, I think it's crucial. Perhaps it's even the most important thing that you can do, and that is able to change, like, so to say, the hearts and minds of people. Because we talked about the decline of Christianity. At the same time, we see now, and it's for the first time that they are doing some research on this topic, is that you see a lot of, so to say, locals converting to Islam. So that's a new phenomenon, so to say. And alhamdulillah, of course, it's beautiful to see. But it's still very small. But it is a development that is really starting to grow. And even so much that a lot of governmental institutions say, well, perhaps we have to do some more research. Why are people converting to Islam? What is it? And of course, it has to do with the fact that there is no, so to say, big narrative anymore. People lost their belief in Christianity. And I can understand why, because if you dive into the religion and you want to grasp it in a rational way as well, it's almost impossible. So the most rational, natural religion is Islam. So people are, so to say, pushed and pulled towards the religion of truth. And when it comes to dawah, I think it's very important, because you see people on the streets, of course, giving dawah. But we have our own, to be modest, we have our own small organizations called Islam Experience Center. And what we do is that we share the basic message of Islam through virtual reality, augmented reality, 8D holograms. So it's like traditional Islam in a Japanese way of presenting. And it's working very well. We've a lot of people taking shahada. We see when we go to schools that people are changing their minds. They said, well, I'm not Muslim all of a sudden, but I didn't know this. I didn't know this story. It's really new for me. And I think that is a problem as well, because later after I converted, you start reflecting about what happened. Of course, there's this change. But I also felt, and that's something I realize more and more now, that I almost was like misled in a cultural way.
Right.
Because
right.
The whole culture is almost anti-Islam, and not so much in a very specific way and very explicit, but very implicit and very on the surface, so to say. And
can you give an example of indirect hostility or this hostile context for Muslims?
Yeah, and to start with, like, say some symbolism. In the Netherlands, you have little towns and cities, but also municipalities, like you have in the UK as well, and they all have their symbols, like flags or whatever, like a lion or an eagle or stuff like that. Wow. And in the Netherlands, you have a few towns, and they have like a symbol with a duck. Without a beak and without the feet. And and first of all, when you look at it, it's like, okay, it's like a strange symbol. why this duck? Why doesn't it have any feet? Why where's the beak? But then, of course, when you start researching, it's fun. Okay, I see this symbol in so many flags and so many like shields and stuff like that. And when I dove into it, I realized that it has to do with the Crusades. Because families who fought in the Crusades and they were trying to, so to say, liberate the Holy Land, Jerusalem, from the infidels, and that's the Muslims in the view of the Christians from the Middle Ages, of course. When you came back and you killed a lot of Muslims, then you were rewarded as a family and they gave you this symbol. So it was like an honor to have this symbol in your family weapon. But some of these families, for example, the family of Kuik. Kuik is a small town in the south of the Netherlands. It was a family, a very rich family. It still is, over, by the way. But they were so powerful that the whole country of Kuik was named after them. So there is now a town called Kuik. But the family weapon of the family of Kuik is the symbol of the city right now. Yeah. But that symbol is this beak without feet and without... the beak. So we have like an anti-Islam symbol in a lot of cities, because it's not only Kuik, we also have Heemstede, that's another town. We have a city called Bergen. And in all these flags, you see this anti-Islam symbol. Then, of course, and it's more theological.
Just to interrupt you. Can I just clarify? Do you think most people understand the significance of that symbol? I mean, do they at some level get it, or is it just a symbol? Do you know what I mean?
Well, nobody knows it. Nobody knows. No, but it's it is a symbol that is there. It's in front of you, but you don't know what it is. So a lot of people know. But it's the same with when you go, for example, some friends of mine are Catholic. And one of them went to Santiago de Compostela. It's like a kind of for the Catholics. So they go to pilgrimage. But insane. But when you go to and if you go to Santiago de Compostela and some people are crawling almost to the church, because that's the, so to say, the end point. But inside of this church of Santiago, the Holy Apostle Jacob, so to say, in English, the brother of Jesus.
James.
James. Yeah. And the thing is that when you enter the church and you are near the altar, where it's like the end of your pilgrimage, you see a very big statue of a man on a white horse with a spear and a sword. And that's the end. But when you look at it, and it says this is Santiago, the holy Iago. But they call him, in Spanish, they call him Matamoros. And Matamoros means... the killer of Moors, the killer of Muslims. Mm-hmm. So you see, when you and you are in the church and you see all these chopped off heads of Muslims with turbans, but when you think about it, this is really strange, because this is like a theological thing. It's a personal spiritual trip. You go on a Hajj, so to say, for the Christians, Santiago de Compostela, and the end of your trip is looking at a statue that's called the Moor killer, the killer of Muslims. So it's very deep in European culture. And to be more political, when you look at the last battle between, so to say, the Ottoman Empire and Christian Europe, was in 1683, right? The Battle of Vienna, that's from the Croisants. For people who don't know the story, of course, in the end, the Western, the Europeans won, and they baked breads in the shape of a half moon. And of course, there was the crescent moon. That's why it's croissant, crescent. And they broke it to say, well, we broke Islam. So also a symbol, of course, of Islam or the competition with Islam. But the thing is, this 1683 thing, the year that this battle was there, is still there because we have an old Euro commissioner. It's called, his name is, well, was Fritz Bolkestein. He was from the same political party of our current Prime Minister, Mark Rutte. And he said, when it comes to the negotiations with Turkey, are they a membership
of the European Union to enter into the European Union? Yeah,
they have the membership of the European Union, and this is like 10, 15 years ago, maybe even 20. And he said, well, if this man, and he's a very big name in the Netherlands still, he's like the Nestor of the Liberal Party, he's like the teacher of Geert Wilders. And so he's a very big name. And Geert Wilders was still in the political party, the liberal political party of the current prime minister. But this guy, Fritz Bolkestein, the Euro commissioner, said back then, well, if Turkey gets its memberships, 1683 was for nothing.
Ooh, oh, yeah.
So it's very deep. And this is like a liberal organization, so they're mainstream. But if these thoughts are in a political parties like that, you don't even need a freedom party. And it's very, if you add it up, all these the symbolism, conscious or unconscious, it tells you a lot about how Europe is in the game, so to say, when it comes to Islam. And nowadays, I think, you have the same problem in the UK as well. When you are a practicing Muslim and you want to vote when there are elections, you almost cut between the left and the right.
Yes.
Because when you look at the right, they say your ethnicity is not good, or we hate your religion because of historical context, etc., etc. And on the left side, they say, well, we love you because you are a minority, but we hate the things you think and the things you believe. We don't like your moral system. So the core of religion isn't there. They don't like it. They don't want it. So if you, to put it, a little bit more explicit, if you're on the right side, you have to pledge allegiance to the flag of Israel, so to say, and on the left side, you have to pledge allegiance to the LGBTQ flag. So you're caught in between. And it doesn't mean, of course, that if you are not left-wing or right-wing, that you all of a sudden hate right-wing people or left-wing people or gays or Jews or whatever. You just want to be yourself. But it's almost impossible because both sides, left and right, are pressuring. And they say, well, you have to deny one part of your identity. And, of course, that's not possible because that's who you are.
I mean, I don't know if they're right or not, that in terms of Sharia, in terms of Sharia teaching, that Muslims are not supposed to live en masse in non-Muslim countries where God's law is not upheld and so on. They're supposed to live in Muslim lands. But Muslims can live in non-Muslim countries if they're doing dawah, if they're business people, they're doing trade, they're involved in diplomacy or other such things. But the idea that millions of Muslims should choose to live in a non-Muslim country, it doesn't seem to be supported by the Sharia because it's potentially dangerous. It's subversive to the faith. If you're in a kufa context, a non-Muslim context with these influences, it's not very conducive to a healthy Muslim lifestyle for all the reasons you've just mentioned. So, but many Muslims came to, say, Britain, were invited here, of course, as migrants, economic migrants, and many took that opportunity to work in our health service, or our railways, or our factories up north, and so on. And they thought they'd go back because this wasn't their home country then. But they didn't. Most of them stayed. I'm not saying they shouldn't have stayed. I'm just saying perhaps the wider context. They did choose to stay. They had children, of course. And the third generation, maybe fourth generation now, is living in the UK. And they're experiencing precisely these problems. They're stuck in the middle between the left and the right. They're vulnerable to LGBT influence and other dodgy influences in schools. And on the right, they're being pushed to support nationalism and a Zionist agenda and so on. So I guess what some people would say that, in a sense, we shouldn't be in this situation in the first place, Islamically, but now we are, because obviously we are, and the Muslims who are born here and others are British citizens, so that is kind of, it's just a reality now. But Islamically, should we even be here? in these numbers as a population, civilian population, just living. I'm not talking about obviously the exceptions of businesses and dower work and diplomatic and so on. But do you see what I mean? Do you think there's a point there? Or
yeah, I think because especially when it comes to dawah, that is like a core mission you should have as a Muslim community, because it's when you look at the Quran, I think it's in Surah 16, Ayat 125, call out to the way of your Lord.
Mm.
But a lot of people don't call out to the way of the Lord. They right. don't call out at all. So they're very busy with the things of dunya. And of dunya. Course, I get it. Yeah, of course, we all do, unfortunately. But it's not what we should do. We should, when it comes to Islam, we should invite people in the best way possible. And I think that a lot of people, especially Muslims, of course, don't do that. And I think that we should. And if you don't, I think it could be a threat for your children to be here. Because I think that, like, the pressure we talked about earlier when it comes to freedom of religion, especially the freedom for Muslims to practice their religion, I think it will become harder and harder the coming years and decades. Because now in the Netherlands, for example, they are talking about circumcision of boys. And they say, well, isn't that a kind of mutilation? And then, of course, we have talked about headscarves.
I just can't help but comment. Mutilation of boys, circumcision, wrong and all that. These very same people, presumably, abortion on demand, which is the mutilation and killing of unborn children, because that's autonomy, woman's right to choose, individualism, freedom. But when it comes to the mutilation involved in killing unborn babies is not an issue, but circumcision is. I was just looking at that incongruity morally, I think, from people who have these views.
Yeah. And there are so many examples of that, unfortunately. But to show how this pressure is growing, in France, for example, when you're not 18, you're not allowed to wear a hijab in public anymore. When we look at, for example, halal food, especially halal meat, in Belgium, and they will do it in the Netherlands as well, they are trying to have like a total ban. They can only import it. You cannot slaughter anymore. When it comes to wearing, for example, dresses, we have seen the example of the jalaba. Were a few boys here in the Netherlands, like 8-9 guys in school. It was like a secondary school. They were wearing a jalaba. And the school said it's a threat. So you have to take it out. And you have to change. And of course, it's ridiculous because there is no law or whatever. But the fact that this school really tried to ban it, and that there was a lot of support here in the Netherlands, and this happened 2 weeks ago. It shows you how this pressure is growing. We have like constant discussions about whether people can pray at work or not. So if people are trying to ban your freedom to pray, I think you have a big problem as a Muslim in this context. The same goes if you're not allowed to eat halal food or you're not able to get halal meat anymore. I think it's a problem. If you are a girl and you want to practice and you don't have a hijab or you're not allowed to wear a hijab, I think you have a big problem. So I can totally understand what you just said, that it's becoming problematic to be here as a big Muslim community. If you don't do dawah, because that should be like the core business.
The dawah essentially legitimizes our presence. Otherwise, we're just like anyone else pursuing the dunya, as you say. And I mean, I don't want to get into the subject of hijra because we're running out of time. But I mean, there are some. I mean, I've been very fortunate recently, the last year or so, to visit some amazing Muslim countries. Qatar, I've been to Doha very recently, in Istanbul, in Turkey, and other places, and these are experiencing major cultural, economic, and religious revival. There's a very sophisticated, I mean, Qatar is a first world country with a very interesting system there, which is very highly developed and religiously very mature, I think, quite balanced and extraordinary beacons, I think, of hope. And not that we could all move to Qatar, it's a tiny little place, really, but I just gave it as an example of hope in a way that there are some amazing Muslim land. I'm not saying they're perfect, of course, but Turkey as well, for all its problems, it has an amazing heritage, and there are many wonderful Muslims there who are doing incredible work in dawah, in scholarship, in Islamic sciences, in the universities there. There's some great beacons for hope. And people are moving to these places from the West. But I'm not saying that's a solution, but nevertheless, it's there.
No, and I think in the end, of course, we don't know Allahu Alam, but we are here. And yes. Some of us are born here. So Apparently there is a reason that you are here.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Really localize Islam, we have to make sure that Islam grows here as well. And there are many good examples in the UK, but also in the Netherlands and in some other parts of Europe, where you see that there's a very... that Islam is flourishing, not only in a religious sense, but also affecting in a very positive way the area where it is, like the mosque. It's starting to make sure that people, that the whole environment, crime rates go down. You see people trying to start businesses, and it's very remarkable to see. But it's, of course, these are small examples, but you don't know. Maybe in the future it will grow. So if everybody should leave, then of course...
I'm not saying, but my comments were historical rather than current. But obviously we have second, third, fourth generation Muslims now. They're British Muslims and or Dutch Muslims and so on. That's now the reality, very much so. So we have to, as I say, find our renewed sense of purpose, maybe in dawah, in localizing Islam, as you put it, finding... putting deep roots in the local culture, reviving civic duties and charity and public works, education, and bringing a vision, a spiritual vision of life, which Europe has lost completely, given the virtual extinction of Christianity in many places. Islam can offer a very compelling, I think, vision of spirituality, of God and the afterlife and so on, and who Jesus was, the historical Jesus, the real Jesus. So I think there's a huge amount of work to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, but I think you cannot really translate it into English, but I always ask, when people ask me, non-Muslims, they often ask me, well, what do you have to offer as a Muslim community? Mm. And of course, when I start explaining them in a theological way, what it meant to me as a person, it doesn't say so much for them, because they're not religious most of the time, the people will ask me. So I always tell them, well, we have the three G's in Dutch, and it's called God, gezin, gemeenschap. It's a lot of g's. But in English it means God, community, and family. So in those three, of course, are core concepts. Of course, we all believe in Allah. We believe in God. That's the main, that's the source of everything. But then, of course, there is the family as well. And you should have a strong family. And, of course, the broader family is your community in your neighborhood, but also in an even broader sense. So, and I always tell them, well, that's what we have to offer. And that is something that everybody longs for. Also, and sometimes people say, yeah, well, perhaps you have a point there. I said, no, it's not perhaps. I know we have a point there, because that is what it is. So inshallah, we'll do something in on the long run here in the Netherlands and in the UK as well. But there's a lot of work to do, as you just mentioned.
Yeah, no, I like that what you said about the family values and cohesion and strength of Muslim families is very well known. We see that in Ramadan, and this attracts a lot of people, because the alternative often is divorce and breakdown and isolation and loneliness and so on, which is endemic in the West at the moment. So there's a real, as you say, there's a real contribution that Muslims can make to reviving the positive values that Islam does offer very much. Well, I know you got to go off to the Dutch Parliament now. You're a busy man. I wish you well with that. I'm certainly going to look into this whole issue of the the Dutch court ruling on is illegal to supply weapons to a country what's committing genocide, but the government ignoring that. And I think this is extraordinary moment, a paradigm shifting moment in Dutch history after the Second World War, where the government basically has gone rogue. It seems just doing its own thing, regardless of the constitution of your country. I mean, this is remarkable, and I'll certainly look into that a bit more, I think. So Thank you very much, Joran, for your precious time, and as always, for your incredible insights into European Muslim life and politics and the existential realities that we all face. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you again for having me on the show. And it really is the whole issue about this joint strike fighter, because that's the name of the airplane, the F-35. It really is a big thing, because if the Dutch government does this, I can imagine that other governments do this as well. Right. And international law goes for international context, so other countries as well. And it's ridiculous to see that on the one hand, to just end with this hypocrisy of a lot of Western countries. And they, on the one hand, you see the Dutch government preaching to other countries, you should uphold human rights, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, they facilitate genocide indirect in Gaza. So it doesn't make any sense anymore. It's really, it's sickening.
No, well, this is very true. Well, that's a very sombering thought. So thank you very much, Joran. And till next time, and best wishes in the parliament this afternoon in Holland. Thank you very much. Take care.
Assalamualaikum.
Assalam.
Thank you.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.